And now, part two of our exclusive interview with Joe Bullinger, the director of the Paradise Lost films, Blair Witch 2, and Metallica, Some Kind of Monster.
Another aspect that I think was just brought up in the third film was the juror notes, where they were using like the Miss Kelly confession in the Baldwin and Eccles trial, which that should have been thrown out, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's outrageous. You know,
yeah.
I mean the level of BS in this trial is just, and in the appeals process is just mind-boggling. You know. Just look at the DNA in the appeals process. Arkansas passed the DNA statute in 2001, which opened the door for Eccles to do a DNA appeal. They argued for years about whether or not he could avail himself of the technology, and then they argued for how it would be done and what lab would do it and how the results would be disseminated. And finally it gets, 6 years after the statute is passed in 2007, they release very dramatic DNA evidence that points away from the West Memphis 3. And it takes a year for Judge Burnett to then, he basically refuses to hear the evidence and declines a new evidentiary hearing. Then they have to go to the Arkansas Supreme Court, which takes another 2 years. Finally, in November of 2010, the Arkansas Supreme Court makes a decision that says, no, lower court, you're wrong. Eccles does deserve a new evidentiary hearing, and then schedules that hearing for December of 2011. 10 years it takes for DNA to do its job in that appeals process. And this is just one element of so many other avenues of appeals that were just denied and not looked at. And, so... 10 years for DNA to prove somebody deserves a new evidentiary hearing or a new trial. But when the state all of a sudden realized it was in their best interest to get these guys out of prison because this evidentiary hearing that was scheduled for December of 2011, when that hearing was going to be embarrassing, within 10 days, not 10 years, they got these guys out of prison. You know, on August 9th, they started discussing this Alford plea, and on August 19th, 2011, and they were out of prison. So when it's in the state's interest, boy, things can move quickly.
I just thought that was amazing, though, because honestly, I'd never heard of that up until the point of that case. But was there any discussion amongst the West Memphis 3 to ride that out and try to go to another trial, where they were just like, it's enough time, Did they ever discuss actually trying to go through that process, I guess?
Yeah. Baldwin initially refused to take the deal. He wanted to wait it out. unfortunately, the prosecutor made it an all-or-nothing deal. All three had to do the deal. And Baldwin initially said no, but then he realized, look, his friend Eccles is on death row, and, he's under... the conditions that Eccles lived under were just brutal. Mm-hmm. And it was just decided by Baldwin that, look, I can't do that to my friend. This could take another couple of years, and his health is failing, and he's in a miserable condition. So to me, Jason's the real hero of this story.
Yeah, I think the end of the third film, just his words were just amazing, the way that was cut together and everything.
Yeah. Did you see it on HBO, or did we send you a DVD? I forget.
Oh, we saw it on HBO. Yeah.
Good.
Now, is there... I was going to mention that.
What did you think of the film?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, I've been waiting. I guess it'd been over 10 years now for the
sequel.
I mean,
we've seen all of these movies, except for
multiple
last one,
times.
Countless times, yeah.
I was going to ask, though, is there a box set in the works of a Blu-ray or something like that, or is that something you're not talking about yet? Or
we're gonna figure something out. Yeah, I haven't. It's been such a crazy period. Finishing the film for Toronto and then changing the end with, the Alfred plea, so that for the New York Film Festival we premiered what you saw on HBO, and then the HBO premiere. And I have a new film at Sundance next week, or actually this coming weekend, it's premiering about Paul Simon, and so it's just as you can see in my voice, I'm also homesick with the flu. So it's just a little much right now. But eventually we're going to figure out what the right thing to do is, you know, for the PL3 trilogy.
Now, I know that Peter Jackson is, he's got a documentary as well, West of Memphis, I think is the name of that one.
Right.
Are there any plans at all to maybe revisit the West Memphis 3 in another 10 years or something? Or is that something that you'd kind of, because the end of the third film was kind of perfect. What are your plans? Or you're just not really thinking about it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know why I feel this way, but I think, well, I know why I feel this way. I mean, to me, like, you know, the West Memphis 3 mythology and machinery has gotten so big, and there are so many people planting flags and wanting to tell the story from different perspectives, which I think is terrific. You know, I'm excited to see the Peter Jackson film. I mean, I love him as a filmmaker, and I'm sure the film is terrific. You know, the Adam Egoyan feature, there's going to be another Devil's Knot book. It's just like, it's enough already, as far as I'm concerned. You know, I was about 30 when we started these films. I'm 50 now. I literally have marked my adult life, because I was not an adult before I was 30. you know, I feel like I've literally marked my adult life, both personally, as I've raised two children. You know, I have a daughter who's, you know, was born during the first film, and a second daughter who was born during the second making of the second film. And, you know, I've marked all the progress in my life by thinking about how these guys are rotting in prison. And, you know, that's what's haunted me and kept us going. And I just feel like it's the end of an era, time to hand the baton off to other people. And for us to continue making films about it would be kind of like milking the opportunity that, for whatever reason, was bestowed upon us, you know.
Right.
Well, I know you've got, I mean, you said you got another project with Paul Simon. I know you're working on one you mentioned earlier called Crude, which is about the oil industry, right? And you'd said that one too. And you had worked on the, I mean, it got really, really good reviews with Some Kind of Monster. Have you ever thought about going back into a music documentary at some point?
Well, Paul Simon is a music film, and it's the first one that has satisfied me since Metallica. You know, after the Metallica film, a lot of bands contacted us to do, you know, on the road films or concert films, and unless there's a deeper story, it's not interesting to me. I mean, what's cool about the Metallica film and about the Paul Simon film is that, you know, those films end where most concert films begin. In other words, you're getting all this rich storytelling and behind-the-scenes stuff, and that's the stuff that I like. Filming music, you know, to me, music is meant to be listened to, not watched, unless there's some other deeper story going on. And, you know, Metallica grappling with the vicissitudes of fame and fortune and trying to figure out how to continue to make music but not live the life that they were living, you know, to me was a fascinating subject. And, you know, the Paul Simon film is the same thing. You know, I go back to South Africa. I don't know if you remember the Graceland record.
Oh, yeah.
Graceland was a big musical achievement, but it's also a record that, you know, got a lot of controversy and criticism because he was accused of having broken the cultural boycott that had been instituted to bring down the apartheid regime of South Africa. And by Paul going in and recording with these black South African musicians, a lot of people in the cultural boycott movement thought that was not the right thing to do. And yet, Paul thought he was doing something quite humanitarian. And, you know, I think the record and the tour did a lot to put a human face on, you know, the talent and the suffering of black South Africans. And yet he, you know, had all this criticism. So we go back to South, for the movie, we went back to South Africa 25 years later. On the surface, it's really to, you know, he's having a reunion with all of these South African musicians he hasn't seen in 25 years. They give a reunion concert. But we use that kind of framework to explore these old wounds and old ghosts and to tell the political story and the musical story. So I actually think it's a pretty cool film.
You mentioned Blair Witch 2 earlier, and that, believe it or not, I think me and Aaron both are kind of fans of the movie. I mean, I kind of agree with you that it towards the end you can tell it was kind of cut to pieces. Do you think, like, the studio just tried to rush the hell out of the movie? Because it was like it came out, like, a year after the original Blair Witch, and it just seemed like they just wanted to capitalize on the popularity quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it was an incredible... I mean, we were writing the script as we were shooting the film. It was incredibly rushed. But, you know, my whole thing was I was kind of doing a satire and making fun of the idea of doing a sequel. That was kind of the original mission of the film, and it had a very different tone to it. And when the studio and everyone, you know, look, I pitched an idea. They all liked it. I wrote a script with Dick Beebe that matched what we had pitched and shot a film that was, you know, perfectly encapsulated the screenplay. So everyone knew what we were doing all along, but some new marketing person came in at the 12th hour and didn't think there was, you know, enough scares in it and wanted to literally see the blood, the killings and, you know, those inserted shots of those gory moments were just, you know, something I objected to, you know, vehemently. And I think it, you know, the whole tradition of the first movie was that the scares were unseen,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a very Hitchcockian way. And I think the big flaw of Paradise Lost, the big flaw of Blair Witch 2 is that, you know, the studio at the 12th hour forced in those gory shots so that you literally, you know, it became a slasher movie, and it's not, it doesn't have the intelligence that I think it once had. I think some of the storytelling still comes through, but it's not a movie I'm happy with at all.
I don't think that they did it intentionally. I just think it happened because it was so heavily edited. But I think one of the reasons why I think that it kind of works is because it's so off balance.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, like, I don't know. It's like there's so many different things going on in it at one time, and it's kind of like watching an Argento movie or something where you're kind of thrown off balance by the way things are put together. And I don't think they had that in mind when they were cutting it, but that's kind of what happened with the film, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I literally have not had the heart to watch it since it came out. I haven't seen the film in 10 years. I barely remember. You know, it's just something I've shut out of my mind.
At the time, though, did, like, that whole experience just sour you on, like, Hollywood films and
totally.
General?
I swore I would never work on a studio picture again. I think I've softened my tune, and the world has changed a little bit, and I certainly would like to do another feature film at some point. But, you know, it was a miserable experience to... I mean, what was a miserable experience was to... You know, they totally left me alone, which is great. And, you know, I did exactly what I said I was going to do, and everyone was happy with it. And literally at the 12th hour, I mean, I was sitting with Carter Burwell, you know, doing the score of a locked picture in August of 2000 with a release date, an impending release date of October of 2000. And at the time, it was one of the biggest releases ever. It was opening in 6 countries on a massive number of screens. I don't remember the number of screens, but it was, like, touted as being one of the biggest openings ever. And I get a phone call that there's a new marketing person and we want more scares. And it was, like, surreal. It's like, you know, it was such bad decision-making at the 12th hour, you know, after everyone had liked the films and everyone lost their faith in what they thought they liked because some new person said, hey, this sucks, you got to do this, that, and this. And it was a nightmare, basically. Even though, you know, and everyone talks about the film being a disaster, it still grossed worldwide like $60 million. You know, it was unrealistic for it to gross, you know, what the first movie grossed, because that was kind of a, you know, a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it did like $25 million on DVD, so, you know, it's a film that still did very well. It was still Artisan's, I believe, second highest grossing movie, but because everyone thought it was going to do $200 million, they considered it a bomb, you know?
I mean, we've talked to the original filmmakers of The Blair Witch, to Daniel Myrick and Ed Sanchez, and even they are somewhat perplexed by how somebody could make that idea, like a sequel to that movie, work. You know what I mean? Like, to make it, like... Because it was such a phenomenon. It was such an iconic film in the way that it was made and everything. And it's basically been ripped off now like 30 different ways. But, I mean, how do you make a sequel to a movie like that where everybody's presumed dead at the end and it's like handheld camera? I mean, I don't know.
Right. That's why the original, like, if, you know, that's why the original idea of my film was to make a sequel to the real life phenomenon of the movie's success, as opposed to making a sequel to, you know, a faux documentary where now the secret's out.
Right. Right.
So that was, and I was kind of making fun of the whole idea of sequelizing a phenomenon. And so my film had a very, my cut had a kind of a satirical tone throughout, and then takes a horrifying twist at the end. You know, the that interrogation sequence, for example, if I remember correctly, was sliced and diced and sprinkled throughout the entire film. Mm-hmm. In my version of the film, you don't realize it's those guys as the killers until the very end of the film, and it was all one long kind of scene, very long scene, and there was no blood and guts in my in mine, because, you know, like, why do you have to literally show that? So, you know, different movie.
Yeah.
Maybe one day someone will release the director's cut of
Blood. I was going to ask, does that exist? Like, does that...
It must exist somewhere. Again, I tried to shut that whole chapter of my book.
Okay.
I got a VHS of it somewhere.
Fair enough.
I need to load it up on the internet and see what happens.
Now, you said that earlier these projects kind of fall into your lap, the documentary project. So how did Crude come about? Like, how were you approached with Crude?
The attorney, you know, that's a movie about a law student in Ecuador where for 17 years these Ecuadorian rainforest dwellers, some of whom are colonials and some of whom are indigenous people in the Ecuadorian Amazon, you know, have been suing Chevron for the activities of Texaco, because Chevron and Texaco merged, but the rainforest communities allege that Texaco, you know, did all sorts of toxic dumping in their communities over the years. And an American lawyer named Steve Donziger was running the case out of the United States. He was the consultant on the case out of the United States, and he and I had a mutual friend, and he came to my office and just told me this story of woe. And my first instinct was, you know, this is not a film I necessarily want to make. You know, it's hard enough to raise money for documentaries, let alone one that takes place in a foreign country. It's going to be in foreign language. You know, I'm not that confident that I want to make this film. And I also, you know, wanted to make it clear that I'm not going to make it from his perspective, that I would want to tell both sides of the story. And but he was very persistent, and he said, look, even if you're not interested or think you're not interested, why don't you come down and take a tour of the region? And yeah, I said, okay, as long as you understand that, you know, if you want to take the time to take me down there, I'm not 100% convinced I'm going to make the movie, or even 50% convinced, but let me go down. But when I went down and saw this devastation, you know, this beautiful rainforest environment, you know, devastated by oil production and indigenous people who's just had this lost look in their eyes, you know, like almost like a cultural genocide, like, you know, their way of life has been destroyed. I just felt like, you know, the universe was kind of tapping me on the shoulder, saying, you know, for whatever reason, you're the guy who has to tell this story because nobody else is. And I felt like a moral obligation. You know, by the time I got home to my nice house in, you know, an hour north of Manhattan, and had a drink of water from my fresh tap water that we all take for granted, and thinking about the plight of these impoverished people who don't have fresh drinking water, I just felt like, you know, I have a moral obligation to do what I know how to do. And so I decided to make that movie.
So were you actually in with the tribes for a while? Did you stay with them, or?
Yeah. I mean, we went back and forth. I wouldn't say, like, I moved down there, you know, permanently, but, you know, we made quite a few trips down there and spent quite a bit of time in the region as the judicial field inspections were unfolding.
There any time during any of these films, documentary films that you made, where you and your crew really felt like you were in danger or felt threatened or anything?
Yeah. You know, when we first got down to West Memphis, Arkansas, some people, you know, made it clear they didn't like outsiders poking their noses around, and After we made the second film, people, you know, made it clear they didn't like us around. So I wouldn't say I felt my life was in danger, but I didn't feel welcome. And there were times when I made Crude. You know, Crude did not feel safe all the time. I mean, we were on the Colombian-Ecuadorian border where the FARC was very active and where kidnappings were not uncommon of Americans. And, you know, I looked over my shoulder quite a few times. But I don't know. I don't worry about those things. I just feel like we're there to do a job, and somehow I just feel protected. Maybe that's naive, but, you know, so far so good.
Yeah.
Do you have any, like, I know there's a lot of filmmakers, independent filmmakers out there right now. Any advice for any aspiring filmmakers, you know, because you've definitely got the experience?
You know, no matter what the mission is, whatever, you know, it's all about character and story. You know, I think a lot of people who want, you know, who are interested in issues and, you know, advocacy or, you know, Paradise Lost worked because we had a great character and situation, and Damien Eccles is charismatic, and, you know, we had great access. You know, I don't think it would have worked if there weren't strong storytelling elements. So having a subject that's worthy of telling is not enough. I mean, unfortunately, movies are about people getting engaged emotionally, and, you know, you got to, even if you're tackling a big subject, you got to figure out a way to do it through human drama and emotion and find good characters and good storytelling. You know, the democratization of filmmaking through technology. You know, I mean, when I shot Bruce Sanofsky, who I should say I've made most of these films, but shot Brothers Keeper, you know, we shot film, and every 10 minutes was $300 by the time you buy your raw stock and expose it and get it developed at the lab, and, you know, and you had to rent a film camera. It was expensive to make films back then. I mean, the beauty of today's world is, I mean, you can shoot a movie on a flip cam, you know, mm-hmm. if you want, or a very professional, you know, machine, you know, prosumer HD camera for $1,000 and edit it on your laptop. I mean, so the cost of entry is much lower than it used to be, but I think that has made a lot of people think that they should be filmmakers, you know, and not everyone should make films.
That's definitely true.
You know, not everyone should make... Look, if you're an advocate and you're pointing at a camera at a something because you're going to load it up on YouTube and you want to expose an injustice, that's great, you know. I hats off to those people, and however you get that out, and bearing witness with a camera, I think is one of the great developments in the history of civilization. I mean, look at what's going on in, you know, the Middle East. I mean, all these revolutions are happening because of, you know, social media and flip cams and camera phones. And I mean, so I'm not knocking that at all. I think the democratization of media is an incredible thing. But if you're going to be a filmmaker, if that's what you want to do, you know, just because you can capture something inexpensively and edit it inexpensively and the cost of entry has gone down astronomically, you know, doesn't make it a film. You know, you got to look for the same old things that people have looked for since filmmaking has begun, which is strong characters. You got to figure out how to tell a story, you know, create a narrative arc. And I think some people go into documentary making simply thinking subject matter is enough. And, you know, it's not. You need to, like, make a, you know, you need to have good storytelling, you know. That's my advice.